Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. I don't know if those Civil War issues were internal to the Simons household or that was a sort of strategy session for you and your wife. I was, of course, dropped. I was dropped from the footlights because I was, quote, not regularly funny. They had a very strict performance measurement target there and dealt with it effectively. It's a great pleasure to be here this morning. It feels like one of my cities of empire. It feels like Hong Kong on a sort of muggy Tuesday afternoon. If you've got any doubts about some of the statistics in those chapters, Michael will more than help you out on some of the details. It's a great pleasure to be speaking from a policy exchange platform still indisputably at the vanguard of contemporary compassionate conservatism. And though we may at times disagree about the precise limits of the market's ability to be the guarantor of social justice, the intellectual depth of your contribution to political debate and in particular to the crucial area of public service innovation is beyond question. What is more, you've always had a keen understanding of the emancipatory power of education, of its unique position within the public realm as the handmaiden of a strong society and a dynamic competitive economy. Under your thoughtful direction, the work of Dean, the work of Annalise, the work of Baron Finkelstein, that tradition is in the safest of hands. But I'd like to begin, if possible, to take the unusual step of suggesting a new research commission for you, because this week, Policy Exchange has published an excellent and timely body of work that should command the attention of all policymakers in 2015. And I speak of the Technology Manifesto, which, amongst many other things, correctly states that the goal of computing education must be broader than a workforce of coders and programmers. And I could not agree more. Our schools will also have to produce armies of algorithm experts, 3D printing technicians, big data analysts, as well as prepare our children, as Andreas Schleicher of the OECD has pointed out, for jobs that have not yet been created, technologies that have not yet been invented, and problems that we don't yet know will arise. And central to this, as the report notes, will be developing a broader educational framework that combines, quotes, technical expertise with analytical thinking, digital skills with creative pursuits, coding ability with business acumen. After all, as Steve Jobs famously said, it is in Apple's DNA that technology alone is not enough. It's technology married with liberal arts, married with the humanities, that yields the results that make our hearts sing. Therefore, I would suggest that looking at how our education system can achieve this alongside delivering the highest standards in English, maths, and the academic basics will be an excellent project for a think tank of Policy Exchange's pedigree. Because when we look at the perfect storm of emerging technologies that will also transform the rhythms and cadences of the contemporary classroom, then I see no reason why we should accept a poverty of ambition when it comes to 21st century schooling. And perhaps today's generous sponsors might also wish to consider their role in such a venture. Which is a roundabout way of bringing me to the theme of my speech today. For whilst the embers of a modern, dare I say it, progressive approach to conservatism may exist at Policy Exchange, the truth is that this is not 2009 or 2010. The Conservative Party is no longer attempting to reach beyond its ideological base, and we are emphatically not all in it together. The Prime Minister seems, to my mind, more animated about placating UKIP sympathisers on his own benches than he is about speaking to a country yet to feel the benefits, certainly in Stoke-on-Trent, of our statistical return to growth. And indeed, you can bear witness to his slow, regrettable retreat by looking at the fate of his modernising lieutenants, some of whom are amongst this think tank's most celebrated alumni. After all, nothing has done more to prevent the big society taking root than the aggressively centralist approach to procurement and commissioning directed by the Cabinet Office. Yes, I'm afraid it's true. Francis Maude, Policy Exchange founder, the murderer of the big society. Then there is your founding director, Nick Bowles. To be fair, few could accuse Nick of not assembling a rainbow coalition. Unfortunately, however, such unity can only be found in opposition to his schemes for planning reform. Yet without doubt, it is the first chair of Policy Exchange, your previous speaker, the Education Secretary for himself, for whom government has been quite the biggest journey. And I use that last word deliberately. I love a journey. I have never read a book like it, Michael Gove once said of Tony Blair's memoirs in 2010. There are so many lessons in it. And indeed there are. However, unlike the Labour Party, the Education Secretary has forgotten nearly all of them. For a start, he has misread how to reform public services, and in particular misinterpreted the former Prime Minister's comments about, quotes, wearing the scars on his back. Yes, you need to move decisively, and yes, you need the courage of your convictions, but you absolutely do not need to set out quite deliberately to take the route of most resistance, to demonise certain sections of the teaching profession as, quotes, the enemies of promise, or to introduce your reforms according to a political timetable that has at times caused administrative chaos in the classroom. Moreover, as Tony Blair's book highlights, you must remain firm and unbending in communicating the principles of your reforms. But if the Education Secretary were following that lesson, how, when we were promised the status of the teaching profession would be elevated, that standards would be raised by, quotes, making it more difficult to become a teacher, how have we arrived at a situation when you need more qualifications to manage a burger bar than you do to teach in classrooms and educate the future of our nation? That is his first misread lesson. The second is that he has forgotten how much effort the former Prime Minister used to put into taking people with him, to reaching beyond his party and building a pluralistic coalition for change. The removal of Baroness Sally Morgan as chair of Ofsted for political reasons is, of course, emblematic, as is his unprecedentedly poor relationship with the nation's teachers. But the third and most important misread lesson concerns the evidence. Because we in the Labour Party know that what our children and indeed our country need most is a pragmatic, what works approach to public policy that draws on best and next practice, takes account of evidence, not dogma, and prepares the country for the future, not the past. Before he began to wear his ideology so zealously, that used to be the Education Secretary's approach too. But on so many levels, whether it be the chaos of the free schools programme, the disregard for vocational excellence, the dismantling of the teaching standards architecture, or the allegations we are beginning to see emerge from Birmingham, the facts on the ground are beginning to call into question the wisdom of his approach. In 2015, the Labour Party will put forward a bold educational agenda to the electorate, raising the status, elevating the standing, and lifting the standards of teaching in this country, delivering excellence in vocational education, a national strategy for improving standards and safeguarding in all of England's schools, and taking seriously, alongside core academic and vocational learning, the nurture of young people's character, resilience, and emotional well-being. But at its heart will be an embrace of the what works pragmatism to nurture college-ready, career-ready, and life-ready young people. So, ladies and gentlemen, that is what I come to set out today and to highlight in particular four crucial areas where the Labour Party is listening to evidence, not dogma, in our mission to raise school standards and deliver an excellent education for all. They are school autonomy, teacher quality, vocational excellence, and the oversight of schools. So in the true spirit of policy exchange, of cooperation and reaching out to stress what unites rather than what divides, I shall begin by highlighting where we agree with the broad thrust of government policy, if not in every detail. After all, pragmatism begins with tough lessons about acknowledging your opponent's insights. And the last thing teachers and school leaders need is five more years of politically driven, frenetic, tinkering and relentless structural upheaval. So I can confirm that we support intelligent accountability led by a dynamic interventionist Ofsted that roots out underperformance. And though I am concerned by the potential for economically crucial creative and vocational subjects to be downgraded, and I will keep a watching brief on perverse incentives, I do consider the attainment 8 performance measures to be an important step in the right direction. So I can confirm that we will not radically overhaul the existing accountability framework. Furthermore, I have long been a critic of the value of semi-vocational GCSE equivalents, which, when abused to boost league table scores, have had a pernicious effect upon often working-class communities like the one I'm privileged to represent in Stoke-on-Trent. So whilst I do not think we need to hollow out the curriculum assessment criteria by removing the practical elements, whilst I do not think we need to narrow the breadth of education our children receive in pursuit of the academic basis, whilst I am worried by the impact of a potential reduction of GCSE options for special schools and their work with disabled children, And whilst I strongly believe that the removal of levels has been a spectacular own goal, as a zealot for ensuring every child in this country receives a world-class education, whether in the pursuit of academic or vocational excellence, I am broadly supportive of the current moves to improve the rigour of our qualification system. What is more, whilst I do not think the Education Secretary's vision is anywhere near holistic or substantive enough, I am pleased that he is belatedly beginning to recognise the importance of non-cognitive skills, such as character, grit and resilience, as a vital part of a well-rounded 21st century education. However, I do think we can do more on the issue of school autonomy. This should surprise nobody. After all, a belief in the professional integrity, moral mission and unwavering civic dedication of public servants is an ideological current that runs very deep within the Labour movement. And from David Blunkett's passporting school funding down to school level in 97, to the code of practice for local authority and school relations in 98, and the dedicated school grant in 06, our record in government points to a party professionally and resolutely committed to giving schools and teachers freedom and independence. Then, of course, there is the evidence of our sponsored academy programme. And let me make it absolutely clear. The sponsored academy programme was one of the last Labour government's finest achievements, a perfect embodiment of the Labour Party's commitment to using education to alleviate social injustice and deliver equality of opportunity. That is not, I'm afraid, entirely how I view the motivations behind the coalition academy programme. Nevertheless, it is the case that there is a groundswell of international evidence in favour of well-managed school autonomy. However, the truth is that it is the Labour Party that wants to push harder on this. Whilst the Secretary of State plays a numbers game based upon an ideological understanding of school type, we are interested in a more value-neutral approach that correctly applies the international evidence. Because what the OECD PISA survey, for example, does not say is that school systems where there is a large number of institutions with academy status perform better than those where there is not. Instead, what it does say is that, quotes, the highest performing school systems are those that allocate educational resources more equitably among advantaged and disadvantaged schools and that grant more autonomy over curricula and assessment to individual schools. So the Labour Party's position is not just that there is far more to raising standards than changing the title and structure of a school, though we would argue that strong leadership, intelligent accountability, and most of all, high-quality leadership, great teaching in the classroom matters more. It is not just that autonomy works best when, like our successful London Challenge programme, it is situated within a collaborative system of partnership and interdependence, though all the evidence points to that as well. Rather, it is that the autonomy and freedoms currently enjoyed by academies and free schools should be extended to all schools. Academies or foundation schools, faith schools or community schools, only under a 2015 Labour government will schools enjoy the freedoms necessary to raise standards that we want to see. But if the government's approach to school autonomy is partisan and partial, its approach to teacher quality is totally misguided. Our starting point is that the surest way to improve our children's attainment is by raising the standard of teaching in our schools and colleges. As educationalists from Sir Michael Barber to Andreas Schleicher, and Michael Barber's new work on Massachusetts absolutely confirms all this, no education system can possibly exceed the quality of its teachers. Yes, innovation, accountability and autonomy underpinned by safeguards and minimum standards matters enormously. But what all the evidence clearly shows is that it is teacher quality that makes the biggest difference to school standards. What is more, its importance is even more pronounced when it comes to children from disadvantaged backgrounds. Research from the Sutton Trust has shown that without social capital or parental input to fall back upon, teacher quality can mean as much as a year's difference to the learning progress of disadvantaged children. So this is a social justice issue for the Labour Party, that we have to make sure that we have great teaching for those who are most disadvantaged. So therefore, my first priority in government would be to make sure that we have a world-class teacher in every classroom, studio or workshop, highly qualified, self-motivating and dedicated professional workforce that reflects upon the evidence and continually inquires about its own craft and practice. And much of what the Education Secretary in his Q&A said on CPD struck that tone. But that has to begin with an end to the deregulation which sees unqualified teachers on an ever-growing scale allowed into the classroom on a permanent basis. But qualified teacher status is the bare minimum, the beginning of the journey that we should expect. It is the correct place for a teacher to begin their professional development, but it cannot be the end. What is more, the traditional policy response of this government and those before it, focusing so much on reforming initial teacher training and attracting high-quality graduates to the profession, will not bring about the step change we need if we are to compete in the Prime Minister's global race. Because what the Sutton Trust and LSE research also highlighted is that if we could just raise the performance of the least effective teachers already in the system merely to the average, then England would rank in the top five education systems in the world in reading and mathematics. And this is the tantalising prospect which motivates us in the Labour Party to think about ways of improving teacher quality across the board. So as well as reversing the government's policy on unqualified teachers, as well as preparing high-calibre graduates and career switchers properly for the pressures of the classroom, under a Labour government, teachers would be expected to undertake regular professional development throughout their careers and revalidate their expertise at regular intervals. Because we believe it is absolutely vital that teachers keep their skills, knowledge and practice up to date. And we also believe that given the pace of progress and understanding of the latest pedagogical or technological innovations, the work I began with is sure to benefit pupils. And we believe that a process of revalidating teachers' expertise would bring them into line with other high-status, mature professions such as lawyers and doctors. But we also believe that we need to look at new ways of encouraging the best teachers to carry on teaching in the classroom as well as attracting them to the most challenging schools. It simply cannot be right that the best teachers feel they need to go into management or leadership to advance their careers. And we want to give teachers who want to build their expertise in a particular subject or pedagogical skill the opportunity to progress while still practicing the craft that first attracted them to the calling. So we will listen to teachers and we will work with teachers in order to draw up a framework of new career pathways for teachers loosely based on the Singaporean system, one of the world's leading education jurisdictions. And we will ensure that there is a place for excellent higher education institutions within the initial teacher training system alongside school-direct classroom-based models. Because what the Labour Party is interested in is empowering teachers to be all they can and should be. Professionals whose job is so important that it requires the very highest levels of performance. This is how we raise school standards and give our children the opportunity to fulfil their potential. But the truth, ladies and gentlemen, is that we must extend this focus, this drive to deliver an excellent education for all beyond schools and into colleges. Speak to any business leader about their challenges, and one of the first things they will say is skills and approach of young people. To compete in the global economy, we need the best skilled workforce. And this is an essential part of Ed Miliband's economic agenda that we'll take to the country next year. High wage, high tech, high innovation economy. So our priority has to be delivering an education system which allows learners to pursue excellence in vocational as well as academic pathways, an issue wildly neglected by this government. And this goes beyond the classroom. We need to drive up the quality of apprenticeships by making them all level three and last for a minimum of 2 years. We need to focus further education colleges on local labour markets by ensuring all vocational teachers spend time in industry refreshing their skills. And I was at Chichester College last week talking to the teachers and lecturers there who regularly go back out to industry, to Rolls-Royce, to make sure their skills are up to date, back into the plumbing sector, so that they're teaching young people exactly what they're going to require. And we need to deliver a sharper focus for further education by accrediting the best colleges as new institutes of technical education to deliver a gold standard technical baccalaureate. Yet if we really want to tear down the deep-seated cultural barriers which have existed so long between vocational and academic routes, we need to do more. This summer marks many anniversaries, and it will also mark the anniversary of Rab Butler's 1944 Education Act. And quite frankly, as you know, our problems go that far back. The technicals, although having read the 1918 Education Act recently, I think they probably could draw on those problems as well. The technical school aspect of the tripartite system was never fully realised, and you could make a convincing case that a lack of focus in vocational education represents one of the historic failings of the English education system. Certainly, it is one of the biggest failings of the current government. And again, this flies in the face of what our young people require. Evidence shows that there is a strong correlation between those European countries with the most effective vocational education system and low youth unemployment. And when you look at our staggering levels of youth unemployment, we can see the correlation working the other way. What we need is a clear and coherent strategy for all learners, one that binds different pathways to success in a rigorous common framework. So I'm delighted to welcome the recent report of the Labour Party Skills Task Force, which recommended that we develop a national baccalaureate framework for all pupils aged 14 to 19. Based on a three-part common core, the national baccalaureate would mean that in addition to A-level or high-quality vocational qualifications, all learners would study English and maths to 18, undertake an extended study or collaborative project, and would develop their character, resilience, and employability skills through a tailored personal development programme that could include work or community service. This should not be seen, and is not, more unhelpful curriculum tinkering. The core learning component of the National Baccalaureate will be made up entirely from existing qualifications. But when we look at the challenges facing our young people today, from global economic competition to increasing mental health problems, then I would argue that the need for a broader approach to education that delivers excellence and opportunity for all our young people, precisely the sort that the technology manifesto suggests, it has never been more stark. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, I want to talk about school oversight. Because there can be little doubt, for the people of Birmingham at least, that this represents the most pressing challenge currently facing English schooling. We have long argued that it is simply impossible to oversee thousands of schools from behind a desk in Whitehall. That the success of the London Challenge programme shows that you need collaborative school structures at a local level, and that England deserves a strategy for improving attainment in every school, particularly for parents of the 1.5 million children currently educated in fragile schools that require improvement. But I have to say, I am shocked and deeply saddened to see allegations emerge that demonstrate our points with such devastating vehemence. There are two interlocking issues here. On the one hand, we have the public policy implications. On the other, there is an issue of basic ministerial competence. And on the latter issue, I'm very sorry to say that the Education Secretary's gross negligence comes with a cost to the education of those children in Birmingham. He was warned of these problems in 2010. He chose not to act, is refusing to answer questions, and what is more, such silence raises further questions. He must come to the House of Commons on Monday and place on record why, as the Home Secretary has asked, he refused to act on warnings and why he rejects the evidence on the need for tougher oversight of schools. Furthermore, in public policy terms, he has been receiving warnings for years that the lack of local oversight in our school system will damage education standards. We are now seeing some of the results. In terms of the leaked Ofsted reports, alleged restricted school curriculum, gender discrimination amongst staff, children exposed to extremist views. Indeed, as a Home Office source, a member of his own party and cabinet said, Lord knows what more they have overlooked on the subject of the protection of kids in state schools. It scares me. The Labour Party has a clear answer to this. A local director of school standards to ensure a system of oversight and accountability at community level. This will allow us to address underperformance and safeguarding in English schools long before it finishes its journey on the long, winding road to Whitehall. However, whilst not detracting from the systematic failings at the Department for Education, given that some of these schools received positive Ofsted ratings in the not-too-distant past, there are also questions for Her Majesty's Inspectorate. There is a broad and lively discussion, kick-started in part by Policy Exchange, as to the next stage in Ofsted's future. And we will hear the verdict of the Chief Inspector, Sir Michael Wilshaw, next week. But I think the time is right for Ofsted to introduce new inspection criteria so that no school can be judged as good or outstanding unless it is delivering a broad and balanced curriculum that will equip our children with all the skills needed for success in 21st century multicultural England. Because, ladies and gentlemen, ultimately that is what English education has to be about. We need to equip young people with the skills, knowledge, and curiosity necessary to compete in the global marketplace. But equally important, we need to offer a rich educational experience that nurtures young citizens, empowers them with the positive freedom necessary to know their own mind and choose how they want to live their life. Make no mistake, this ethos will be a tremendous challenge for an education system that at times can seem a little dominated by a managerial, target-driven performance culture. Yet it is by no means impossible, because what very recent history also shows us is that school and college leaders are capable of delivering quite remarkable improvements when the policy is rooted in the evidence, when the profession is properly motivated, when we look to the future, not the past, and when we ally that with local collaboration and hard-edged partnership. We saw what it could do with the remarkable success of London Challenge, turning around life chances for some of our most disadvantaged young people in places like Tower Hamlets, Hackney and Haringey. We have seen it work with the Raising Achievement Transforming Lives programme and the network previously brought together by the Specialist Schools and Academies Trust. And we have seen it with the collaborative approaches of forward-thinking local authorities such as Wigan, places where the shameful link between economic status and educational attainment is beginning to break down altogether, where background does not define their destiny and poverty places no cap upon individual aspiration. In 2015, only the Labour Party will be truly able to offer such an approach, sounding the death knell for low expectations and delivering educational excellence for all our young people. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Shadow Secretary of State. Again, we'll have some questions there. The woman at the back, there's the first question. Thank you.
My name's Simone Aspis. I'm from the Alliance for Inclusive Education, which is an organisation that promotes and campaigns inclusive education for disabled learners. I just had to just iterate from both speakers. The only mention of disabled children was around special schools. And with disabled children declining in numbers of disabled children declining in special mainstream schools, with a number of disabled youngsters accessing mainstream courses, and with disabled young people who are going to find it increasingly difficult to access higher education underneath this government's policy regards to the closing down the Independent Living Fund and also the reforms of the Disabled Students Allowance. Just wanting to know what you might do to be considering reforming the Children Families Act so that disabled children and young people have the right to access mainstream education, because you did say education was a social justice issue. Thank you.
Absolutely. I mentioned special schools because I was in one yesterday talking to teachers in Newcastle-under-Lyme, and the issue was really raised about their fears over the tightening of the GCSE, Ofqual's consultation on the tightening of the GCSE numbers and what that might mean for their students. But having just had the Children and Family Act passed, I think we've got to begin to see how this is working, and it points to my earlier point that we don't want the kind of relentless change in terms of education policy of political decisions when one government comes in and another leaves in terms of throwing everything up in the air again. So I think we need to see how the Children and Family Act is going to play out in terms of all those issues from plan to elsewhere. I think you're right about calling myself and the Education Secretary up about the only reference within special schools. But my view is, having had this debate over the last 2 years about that act, and there are lots of debates one side or the other on, let's see how it plays itself out, and then let's have, as we will do with the curriculum and other areas of policies, have a midterm review about its implications and absolutely have that conversation.
Okay, thank you very much. Next question, gentleman over there.
Oh, Hello, my name's Chris Bolton. I'm a maths teacher. And early on, you described the elimination of levels as a spectacular own goal. Now, it didn't take me very long in teaching to recognize how completely ineffective the level system was for recording progress. Almost everyone whom I know, whom I've worked with, has hated the level system in all the subjects. So for me, and for a lot of people I know, getting rid of the levels is a brilliant thing to have happened. And while we don't have anything to replace it yet, I know a number of people who are working on systems now to replace those levels. So I'd really like to know on what basis you're describing that as a spectacular own goal, because you're making it very difficult for me to, as much as I might like to vote for Labour next year, when you're making statements like this, which seem to be completely incongruous with the sentiment in schools and amongst teachers.
The reason I make that statement is based on the conversations I've had with education leaders, with academy chains, with school teachers across England, and particularly for children from disadvantaged communities who are often in rented accommodation, who are often moving from school to school with high levels of frequency. And levels provided some baseline assessments which countered low expectations about what these young people could possibly achieve, demanded the pushing of the most, you know, the most able. And I think the wholesale removal of that, and it speaks to the broader sort of deregulation agenda of every school and island, of not having comparators between them, is, I think it is an own goal in terms of a progressive state education system. Now, I'm all up for improvement. You know, I'm all up for making the level system work more effectively and reform, absolutely. You know, let's have that conversation. But I also think we need some common and effective standards between schools so that we're challenging young people, we're not allowing the most disadvantaged to fall further behind, and we're also not having a culture in some schools of low expectations, because what could you expect from kids from this background? And that's my motivating principle. But let's have the conversation about reform and take it forward, but we need standards on that.
Okay, thank you very much. Charlotte in the red.
Charlotte Veer, representing the independent school sector. Michael Gove mentioned in his speech the potential for qualifications reform, further qualifications reform in the next parliament, which struck fear into my heart, I have to say, a little bit. What's your position on this?
We don't like what's happening in terms of AS and A levels and the decoupling. So we will move quite swiftly on that. We think a period of stability and reflection in terms of qualification reforms is necessary. And I think our focus, to be honest, is going to be much more on the vocational side of the equation rather than the academic. I think we do need to look at some of the, you know, and to be fair, you know, Matthew Hancock has begun this, some of the array of qualifications out there and the language surrounding them and the understanding of them, because young people's ability to navigate those qualifications seems incredibly arduous for them. So if we had a focus on that area, and, you know, what is our focus on? It's local oversight and accountability, it's teaching standards, it's early years as well. Our focus will be more on the vocational rather than on the academic side. But I think after the, you know, having introduced what he's introduced, you go and talk to schools and, you know, where's the implementation? Where's the training? I actually think the way you make real reform over time is to allow for these things to bed in, reflect on them and deliver them effectively.
Okay. Gentleman right in the far corner over there.
Hello, I'm Nick Linford, editor at Academies Week, which launches in September, but we know each other from FE Week. It was interesting to hear Michael Gove talking about vocational from 16. I've got a question about really the pathway from 14, and you've just again reiterated in power you would focus on vocational. Just this week, FE Week has reported that UTC has been taken off Lord Baker, by Michael Gove and given to the local college after a grade four, and we've only had two other inspections, and they were both grade threes of UTCs. So I'm not sure it's going too well. On the other hand, colleges this year can now recruit at 14 directly, which is new, and so far all of the five colleges have been seen by Ofsted and have come out with glowing monitoring visits reports. Would you be encouraging colleges to do more direct recruitment at 14?
I would, and it speaks to what we talked about earlier, I would encourage colleges to be part of an education community, which means that if a young person wants to do, you know, the engineering, if a young person wants to do the technical and vocational pathway at 14, they can go to college, do that as part of their program. And we have a waiting system, which means that it is in the interest of the school to allow that to take place, that everyone benefits from that kind of relationship. At the moment, because of the sort of competitive, atomistic nature of the school's market, the total determination of schools to hold on to every pupil at every point, even if it's not in their best interest, those kind of permeable relationships are not there. So I would want, and again, you go and speak to the best schools and the best colleges, and they're talking to one another, and they know what their young people need, and they allow them to work across institutions. So at 14, absolutely, to have those... to have those relationships. I think it is interesting that where the education debate is moving in terms of the 14 to 19 space and studio schools and university technical colleges and further education colleges are part of that. So I would urge them, and that's why we want a director of school standards, that's why we want the London Challenge model of partnership and collaboration and challenge, so that we use all of these education facilities. What we have in our current education system is this, you know, desire to throw huge amounts of capital expenditure at setting up relentless new schools, when actually we have lots of existing institutions which could be used more effectively between and amongst one another. And we should use those resources more effectively.
OK, we've got time for one last question. The woman at the back there.
No pressure. It's the last question. Everyone else is disappointed down here. Better be good.
Thank you. You talked quite a lot about international comparators, which I think is laudable. And I think the idea that we should be looking internationally for good examples of best practice is great. What do you intend to do about the regional inequalities that still exist in the UK, though? Would you roll out London Challenge with adequate funding across the UK?
Well, this is, again, I think where the debate has shifted over the last, you know, 10 to 15 years. The challenge of high poverty inner urban districts is still there, but the challenge is also in Hastings, in Grimsby, in Herefordshire, in Stoke-on-Trent, in the Isle of Wight. And our answer to that is yes, to use some of the methodology behind London Challenge in terms of partnership, challenge, cooperation between and amongst schools within an arena of trust, but with a hard-edged focus to it. Because the point about London Challenge was also about using the data to identify fragile and underperforming schools and having honest conversations between and amongst school leaders about how to deal with that. And having a wide field to draw down on excellence. And the government knows their policy is sort of ideologically over in terms of a sort of marketised, isolated school system, which is why they're introducing regional commissioners. They've sort of given up the ghost on the ideology of it. But their regional commissioners are just about academies and free schools. They've got no real focus on improvement and challenge at a local level. So our local directors of school standards would roll out the principles of London Challenge on a broader scale. But we've got to be honest, we're not going to have the same degree of resources that we had for the London Challenge in some of those years. But we also know that, you know, why did Tower Hamlets had huge amounts of resources and it was underperforming. It had equally, you know, healthy amounts of resources and it performed far more effectively. So money in and of itself is not the answer. It's about leadership, collaboration, partnership and challenge.
Okay, well, excellent note on which to end it. Can I just again say thank you very much to the Shadow Secretary of State. We can show our appreciation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Have you got time for the media?
Yeah.